It's Pro Savings Days at Lowe's. Get up to 35% off select major appliances and save an additional $1,000 when you buy four select LG major appliances. Plus, get a free DeWalt 20-volt max 5-amp-hour battery when you buy a select DeWalt 20-volt max tool. Get the job done for less at Lowe's. We help. You save. Valid through 9/26. Selection varies by location while supplies last. See associate or Lowe's.com for more details and qualifying items.
With Robinhood, not only can you trade individual stocks and ETFs, you can also seamlessly buy and sell crypto at low costs. Trade all in one place. Get started now on Robinhood.
Trading crypto involves significant risk. Crypto trading is offered through an account with Robinhood Crypto LLC. Robinhood Crypto is licensed to engage in virtual currency business activity by the New York State Department of Financial Services. Crypto held through Robinhood Crypto is not FDIC insured or SIPC protected. Investing involves risk, including loss of principal. Securities trading is offered through an account with Robinhood Financial LLC. Member SIPC, a registered broker-dealer.
Tommy, I am so tired. We've had such a long day because yesterday we had quite the misadventure.
Yeah, so we got stranded a few hundred miles from home in a car that we were pretty unfamiliar with, without the correct parts to get us back on the road in like 85 degree heat, 90 degree heat. So it was a pretty big day.
And a rainstorm.
And a rainstorm.
We'll tell you, and of course, diarrhea.
Yes, there was a lot of diarrhea involved.
There's a lot of diarrhea. So, for our 300th episode, let's talk about the pitfalls of buying classic cars, because there are a lot of mistakes you can make, and we have done them all.
Yeah, well, we did them all in one day, which was pretty amazing.
Yeah, that is pretty amazing that we managed to fill all of the mistakes into one day. But I have to say, Tommy, most people, when they buy a classic car, would probably not fly down 1,000 miles to go drive it back 1,000 miles without actually having a purchase inspection, and yet that was the very first mistake we made. So let's take a step back and let's go back to a car that we bought like a month ago, which is the Dodge Viper, the very first generation, the 94 that we own.
Yeah, so we bought this RT10 Viper to do a series on Tito Classics with, and it's a really cool car, right? It was one of the top dog American performance cars of the 1990s. So we thought it would be cool. We had this idea a little bit after buying that.
And everything went right with that. We bought it here. Found it on Craigslist.
Yeah.
And the car was everything the owner said it would be and more. And we had a really great experience. It's been bulletproof. I spent a little bit of money on it because it didn't have the right wheels, but this is not a big deal. So we found the right wheels. We found the right tires. I also was pleasantly surprised when the car had this, like, you know, really goofy Kenwood radio with all the lights that light up. And then the owner said, I think there's something else in this box. And I opened up the box and it was the original radio. So we had that put in. Just a delightful experience and a car that is every bit as good and as every bit as fun as I thought it would be. And the owner also, without even mentioning in the ad, had both the soft top and the hard top. By the way, those hard tops are worth a lot of money. We bought the car for $40,000, which is, you know, for a Viper, not that bad.
I think it's kind of top of the market for that car.
You think?
Yeah. I mean, I think the reason that car was so good is because we paid all the money for it. I'm not sure.
I've seen them up to as much as the Roadsters, at least. The GTs are more.
GTSs are like 60.
No, they're like 90.
But yeah, but a Roadster, I think an early Roadster like ours, even with the low miles, 40 is kind of all the money. Maybe 45 on an auction site. But I mean, I think we got lucky with that car in that it was very well loved and very well maintained. But we also really paid out the nose for it, I kind of think.
I don't think so. I think we got a fair price. I think the guy threw in everything that he had. So we have the soft top, we have the hard top, and that car is, you know, in great condition. Everything works on it. There's one issue with it, but that, I mean, you're never going to buy a classic car, even, you know, sub or post $1 million without some issues, right? Every classic car is going to just come with a slew of issues. This one has one issue, and it's not a big issue. It's very much a Viper issue. When you first go to start it, it just cranks because it takes the fuel pump a little bit of time to get the fuel into the...
It's got two issues.
What's the other issue?
Air conditioning doesn't work.
Yeah, but that's pretty... Apparently, the air conditioner, even when it did work, wasn't very...
So let's keep going. So we bought this Viper,
yeah,
and we thought it'd be really cool to find the stablemate of the Viper. We can do some really neat videos if we can track down a C4 Corvette 01, which was king of the hill back in the 1990s. That's what Chevrolet called the C4-01.
They both had about 400 horsepower. It would have been a direct competitor to the Viper.
Yeah, and they were both very expensive machines. When the C4-01 launched in 1990, it was one of the fastest cars on the planet. Not even for American cars. It had a top speed of 180 miles an hour, did 0 to 60 in under 5 seconds. It set all these endurance records by traveling 12 hours, 24 hours at averaging over 170 miles an hour. I mean, it was an amazing performance machine. LT5 overhead cam V8, really a cool car. And pretty hard to find. They only built about 6,900 from 5 years from 1990 to 1995. So they're not that common.
And now with the new ZR1 coming out, we thought it'd be a good time to get that classic ZR1. It also has this cool feature where you get a key and you can change the horsepower from basically low power mode to high power mode. What is that all about? How does that work?
Well, the ZR1 engine, the LT5, was a real technological marvel, especially for General Motors, who had been producing largely the same architecture small block for many, many years. So General Motors at the time owned Lotus, and they went to Lotus and said, we'd love to do an overhead cam engine. So Lotus took their L98 C4 engine at the time, put overhead cam heads on it, and it didn't work. It didn't fit in the car because C4 engines mount from underneath in the assembly line. It didn't fit through the wheel wells and frame rails, okay? So then they designed an all ground up new engine called the LT5, which was dual overhead cam based on an engine they already had in development. Problem is it had the wrong bore centers. So then they did it again so they could keep with GM small block heritage, get those standardized bore centers. And what you ended up with was a 5.7 liter small block V8 that was an all aluminum construction with 16 fuel injectors, 16 intake runners, and 3 throttle bodies. So when you turn that key, it enables 8 of the 16 intake runners and injectors.
How many valves?
32 valves in total. So it's a magnificent engine.
It's a moonshot for GM.
375 horsepower. And the crazy thing is Lotus didn't have the capacity to build it. GM didn't have the facility to build it. So GM then took that Lotus design and went to Mercury Marine, to their Mercruiser division, who had a lot of experience doing aluminum boat engines, and the Mercruiser largely hand-built the LT5 specifically for the ZR1.
Yeah, and then the car, uninterestingly, looked very similar to the regular C4. This is where I think GM kind of screwed up, because they didn't make it look as, I would say, fierce as the engine was, is.
And the reasoning I've read behind that is they didn't want to outstage the standard Corvette buyer. So they didn't want the standard Corvette buyer to feel like they're getting second fiddle, which is a dumb thing. We know now that Corvette buyers love having differentiation in their cars. They don't mind being outstaged by a Z06 or Z01 or a Z51 package. It's kind of just part of the appeal, right?
So it was wider, but you couldn't really tell. It was wider, and then it had square lights instead of round lights and the taillights.
But then in 1991, every Corvette got the square taillights, so you really had to be an enthusiast to tell a ZR1.
Yeah, these little black like tabs next to the license plate that let you know that it's a ZR1 because it's wider and they had to put something in there. And so they put these like little black tabs, I guess.
And then it's got the center high-mounted stoplight instead of the brake light in the rear fascia. So there are ways to tell a ZR1 from a normal C4.
If you know, you know.
Yeah, and then there's a lot of other changes. Like it had 315 width rear tires, which was insane. It had standard sport bucket seats. It had active suspension.
We'll get to those in a second.
Yeah, 18-way active suspension. I mean, really advanced stuff for the 90s. Very electronically controlled, but it was an amazing car. It just didn't look amazing enough.
And how much did regular C4 cost?
It was about $28,000.
And how much, if you got the ZR1, there was a ZR1 package, how much did that cost?
Roughly doubled it. So standard Corvette 30, ZR1 option package, the single most expensive option ever installed in an American car. It was another $30,000. So it was a $60,000 car.
And then the one we bought, somebody actually paid $20,000 over sticker when they originally bought it. In today's money, how much would that be?
So the sticker on the car is $61,000. That's about $158,000 in today's money. But the original owner bought it for $85,000, which is the equivalent of $222,000 is what someone paid for this Corvette.
Yeah, so we found this one in Phoenix, and I love Phoenix because it allows us – I love flying down and then driving home. I think that's one of – for me, more than the car, the experience is what I really value. And the chance for me and my son here to go pick up a dream car – one of my dream cars on my birthday, right? Which it was my birthday. was, you know, an opportunity too good to miss. So we, you know, went on, bring a trailer, and we found this car. And, you know, without a pre-inspection purchase, we purchased it. And I think the problem with bring a trailer is that you get a lot of pictures, and if you know what you're doing, you can make a car look really good without knowing what the internals are, right? So the exterior and the interior are fabulous. How many miles on our car?
26,000.
Which is great, right? Mm-hmm. For a 35-year-old car, 26,000 miles. But, you know, you don't know what's going on with it mechanically, which we will get to in a second. So for me, it was kind of a bucket list. On my birthday, fly down to Phoenix, pick up this car, drive to Moab halfway.
Well, and it's worth noting, too, that, like, realistically, bring a trailer and cars and business and all these sites recommends that you get a pre-purchase
inspection.
But
nobody does.
But it's in the real world, especially when you're 1,000 miles away, facilitating that owner to take time out of their day to go bring the car to some mechanic. You don't know if you can trust the mechanic. You don't know anything about them.
He could bring it to his buddy. You just don't know.
Yeah, to go look at the car and then facilitating that over the phone. And then you got the auction ending in 3 days when we found this car. Like, it's realistically, I know we should be doing it, but it's very difficult to make that happen.
So these cars are coming up in value. We paid $27,000 for ours. If you go to Hagerty, it says it's worth like $23,000. And I always feel like that there's like a 25% premium, at least when you buy stuff on Bring a Trailer. There's, you know, there's just this like bring a like a restaurant sheen when you go to a restaurant and foods. There's a Bring a Trailer sheen on these cars. And I always feel like you're overpaying. But having said that, they're not easy to find. It's like when we bought that World War II Jeep, right? You're not going to find one probably on your local Craigslist. Or you might, but it's going to be far and few between.
And realistically, like if you go to BAT right now and just type in C4ZR1 and you look at some of the prices that these things are commanding, like they're pretty big money. So let me just run down some of the recent sales. So one sold for $29,000, one sold for $27,500, one sold for $45,000, $32,000, $45,000. So like they can be anywhere from $25,000 to like $50,000. This one sold for $53,000 even. So, you know, pretty big. One sold for $100,000. Look at that one. So they can be very expensive. And it's because they're very interesting cars. Not that many made. Only 6,900. Most of them are pretty low miles. Very few of them have miles on them. They were just kind of stored and not driven as collector's items. They're expensive cars.
Yeah, so the first problem came right away, and that is you came to pick me up at like 6 in the morning so we could fly down there and get there early so that we could drive back up. And you were having some stomach issues. You were having a little bit of diarrhea, I believe.
Yeah.
So that was already a bad sign. And it should have been a precursor or a premonition of what was to come, or foreshadowing, I might add. So we get on the plane, and the plane is, of course, delayed. Actually, we got very lucky. I guess there was a haboob. Is that what they're called?
There's basically a huge sandstorm in Phoenix.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we get to Phoenix. We Uber over to the owner. My bank doesn't like when I send money orders because they feel like if you transfer money
via, they like a wire.
They don't like wires because once that wire is gone. So luckily, our bank was also in Arizona, so we had agreed to go to my bank, and then we would cut a cashier's check at the bank for the $27,000, which reassures the owner that the money is in the account, because once you cut that cashier's check, they take that money out of your account and you can't use it.
But you can forge them.
You could, but
which is why people don't like cashier's checks.
But if you do it at the bank,
it's pretty hard to forge.
Yeah,
at the bank.
I mean, yeah. Unless you have some kind of surreptitious agreement with the bank teller.
And listen, the big problem with this whole process is that we had to be back in Boulder Tuesday night.
Yeah.
So we had 2 full days to drive 1,000 miles, and that includes flying out, looking at the car, buying the car, getting the title sorted, and then driving it 1,000 miles back to Colorado. So we were very much under time crunch. So we got there, took a quick look at the car, and it looked fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, the owner was wonderful. He had polished it.
Exterior was like a 10.
It was a two-owner car. So it had lived in California, which is great, for much of its life. And then I think the Arizona owner had owned it for 5 years.
Something like that, yeah. So it really, like, visually, it's pretty much flawless. The salad spinner wheels are great. Tires are new. Has some service records with it. Interior is perfect.
Had the original window sticker.
Yeah, it's got both tops. So visually, it looked great, right? I did want to just take it for a quick drive, even though technically we were committed to buying that car because that auction had ended, right? Like we were on the hook for $27,000 for that car, but hopped in it, started up, started first try, took it around the block, First gear, second gear, third gear, got out to fifth, felt pretty good. Engine was cold, fired up, transmission was cold, all good, right? Park the car, go do the bank thing, right? Come back and get in the car. And then that's where things get a little sketchy.
Well, so when we got there, we were like, okay, there's like five different things, you know, that are good about the car. There's, of course, the engine. We thought the engine was strong, right? There's the transmission. There's the interior. There's the exterior. And then there's kind of just the overall, like feeling that the car gives you. And all five of those things, when I saw it, were great. So I'm like, okay, we got really lucky. We got another Viper. I'm just, you know, living a good life, so God has rewarded me on my birthday. Little did I know that that was not true. But anyway, so we get in the car, and the first issue that I had, even on the test drive, is it's got these sports bucket seats.
This isn't the test drive at this point. This is after we bought it.
I know, but I noticed it on the test drive. And the problem is, if you're aware of like modern BMW competition seats, right, or Porsche competition seats, so these bucket seats that have very high side sills on the side, and then of course very much bolsters on the side as well. And if you're looking at these pictures, you can see that the vet has kind of a confusing array of buttons to control how the seats work. On the right side, there's these three little buttons which are unmarked. On the left side, there's two buttons which are marked. So I'm figuring on the test drive, what I can do is I can kind of open up the side bolsters and the bottom bolsters so that my big fat American ass fits into them.
Mm-hmm.
So I get in the car on our drive back, and the first thing I do is I figure out how to open up the side bolsters, and I'm like, wow, that's great. That's much more comfortable. They're no longer squeezing me on my side.
Right.
And now the problem is that I'm not sitting in the seat. I'm sitting on top of the seat because the side bolsters are open, but the bottom bolsters are closed, mm-hmm. and there is no way to open them up.
Hey, wake up. New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
In other words, if you have a big ass like me, you either sit with one cheek in the seat or you sit with both cheeks kind of resting on top of those bolsters.
Yeah.
Which is not a comfortable way to drive for 1,000 miles.
Right. And then the other issue we figured out, especially as the transmission warmed up, is that the first gear grinds. So you can kind of sort of get around it by going to second. Basically, we think, in my opinion, the synchro has probably gone bad on first gear.
First gear synchro is gone.
So you can use the second gear synchro to get into first smoothly, which basically shifts into second and first, but first gear synchro grinds. First gear works. Like it holds. It doesn't pop out. It accelerates like it should, but it does grind going into first. So that was like the first kind of really big disappointment. And that was, I take full responsibility. I feel really bad about it. I should have driven the car more on the test drive and more that transmission.
And the owner kind of gave us a hint we should have listened. He said, never downshift into first. And I was like, well, maybe that's like a ZR1 thing. But basically what it is you can't downshift into it because the synchro is gone.
Right.
And the problem is it doesn't have a standard Corvette transmission.
Well, it's got a ZF6, but it's like a different ZF6 compared to a standard C4. So it's gonna be a very expensive fix to get that thing back.
There are specialists who work on these, but it's not gonna be like you take it to your local transmission shop and have that synchro fixed. It might be a transmission outfix if we want to not live with it. So that was kind of disappointing. Look, I don't blame the owner. I blame us, right? We bought this car.
Sure, right.
We should have known better. I don't think the guy was being dishonest. I just think he had the car and he used it to drive. On the weekends, the car's a coffee. It's one of those cars where I think he probably spent more time polishing the exterior than fixing the interior. Well, when I say interior, I mean engine. Even though he did tell us he spent $10,000 like replacing injectors and putting on new tires, so I could be wrong about that.
Yeah, I think when you mean interior, probably mean
like engine and mechanics.
Yeah, mechanics of it. I think that there's a lot of really good things about the car. Like it's a very straight car. It's got a pretty good ownership history, right? Engine feels pretty strong, suspension's excellent, brakes are good, steering's really good. It's just like we learned pretty quickly that transmission's going to need some love. And I was hoping maybe we could get away with like, maybe it's just like a master cylinder for the clutch master that's gone bad, but that's been replaced, that's been gone through. So that tells me that this has probably been a persistent issue for quite some time. But regardless...
And you don't need first. It's not a very, popular... I'm kidding. You need first.
Yeah, it's first is a pretty big one.
Yeah.
But so we went and we took the car and we went to our favorite hot dog chain in Phoenix.
Well, I don't want to. So this, here's the problem. So we went to Portillo's, and I'm from Chicago, and I love Portillo's. And I had my Italian beef, which is great. And then like 8 hours later, I was fertilizing northern Arizona and southern Utah, jumping out of the car. Luckily, you had brought some toilet paper.
Yeah, because I was having issues a little bit earlier. So it could have been that we just both got a stomach flu, right?
Well, or I'm also using that, like, not Ozempic, but like the like something like Ozempic, which is supposed to make you... thin and sick to your stomach, which it has accomplished that, not the
both
first
those
thing.
Goals.
Not the first one yet. So it could be the drugs that I'm on, you know, to try to get some weight loss, or it could be, you know, whatever I ate. But anyway, it turned out to be a pretty bad, I couldn't make it. When I had to go, I had to go. Right. It was like, pull over now, Tommy, and run into the bushes and, you know, do my thing and then run back into the car. So that was already unpleasant. But before we even got to that part of the journey, we did the great pillow hunt.
Right, because we got our hot dog, we got gas, we had some stomach issues. But the big thing is we those seats, even for me, and I'm a pretty skinny guy, like those bolsters are pretty unlivable. I know Case had this car and he lived with them, but the bottom bolsters are so tight that after 2-3 hours of squeezing your hips, like you just want to be out of the seat. So we had the idea, well, let's see if we can find a pillow to kind of elevate us above the worst portion of the bolster, which is against the bottom.
Yeah.
So first we went to Tractor Supply. It was the closest store.
And we found two pillows.
Yep, so we got like a little outdoor pillow. And that actually...
That worked for you.
That did the trick for me, yeah. Because it elevated me like an inch off the cushion. And then I was pretty comfy.
Yeah, it could be also. How much do you weigh?
180.
Well, I am about 70 pounds more than that.
Well, I doubt that's part of the problem.
So yeah. It could be that my big ass was squishing the pillow too much. But you combine that problem with the fact that the wheel well is super tight. I was just listening to Doug's podcast, and he was driving his Countach around Pebble Beach, mm-hmm. And he was doing it without shoes on. Remember when we did that Murcielago video, and the guy showed up, and he didn't have his shoes?
Yeah.
There was something like in the 90s where all these supercars had very tight footwells, and this is no exception. So it's not as tight where you can't drive it with your shoes, but... Once you put both feet into the footwell, they're not going anywhere.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, sure.
So now I'm like one cheek into the seat, one cheek out, one foot into the footwell, one foot out of the footwell because like two don't really fit. And I'm kind of, you know, going between one cheek to the other cheek. And it was just freaking miserable.
So
we got these pillows and it made it better. But then I was able to kind of raise myself. But then the problem becomes that my head hits the ceiling.
Right. So we drive from Phoenix to Flagstaff, Arizona.
And then go for the great pillow hunt again.
Yep. So we find a JCPenney.
Yeah.
And they have a huge variety of pillows.
In a horrible, horrible rainstorm.
Yeah. Really.
This car has not seen rain in like 5 years.
I don't know if it's seen rain in 20 years. I mean,
maybe not. Yeah.
Yeah. But God, this thing got just drenched.
And then, of course, when it got drenched, the TPMS light came on, which I guess it's a common failure point on these, but we were like, hey, it doesn't have the TPMS failure point. And then, of course, the second it got wet, the TPMS light came on.
Immediately came on.
Yeah.
But we found a JCPenney. We went on this great pillow excursion. We tried the Tempur-Pedic pillows and the normal down pillows and all these different types of pillows. And finally...
I found a memory foam pillow on sale for $50.
Settled on the memory foam. And then put it in the car, and that kind of solved your problem for most of the trip.
Well, it solves one problem. The other problem is when this car was built, they wanted to make a target top, and this came with the two tops. But unlike most target tops, you have to have a tool to actually put it in place mm-hmm. because it's actually a structural part of the vehicle.
Yeah.
And to solve the fact that they had a target top, they made the sills super tall. And so back in the day, the reviewer said you either, you know, climb out of it or fall into it. And it's absolutely true. So now I've got this tiny seat with this pillow that I'm trying to position underneath myself as I'm trying to climb over this like 10-foot sill to get into it.
Yeah.
And it's just a comedy of errors getting into the car and getting the pillow actually positioned in such a way that, you know, blood circulation is not cut off to either one leg or the other.
Mm-hmm.
So it was not a very... poetic way to, you know, get in and out of the car.
But to the car's credit, like we did drive it from Phoenix to Moab, Utah. That was our plan. That was about a 7.5-hour drive. And it did that, I think it was like 400 miles, 450 miles.
Yeah, once
like
you're in fifth or sixth, it's great.
Yeah, and it was a pretty good cruiser. Like it's very stable on the highway.
And the active suspension works?
Yep. You've got comfort, sport, and then performance. And that really does change the whole character of the suspension, which is very impressive. And it was a great road trip car at 70, 75, 80 miles an hour. And it got pretty good fuel economy. Like when you had it on the highway in sixth, you do over 21, 22 mpg. So like there's it was really good. And then the part that was the riskiest of this drive is like Flagstaff to Moab, you go through the reservation.
And there's nothing there.
There's Tuba City. Nothing.
And then there's Monticello, right?
Yeah, but there's like almost no city, like hundreds of miles of just kind of desolate desert.
Yeah.
So that it would have been a really, really big problem if it had broken down in that stretch.
The way that it did when we're about to tell you how it did.
Yeah, so it did. It made it through that section and it did great. Drove it through into Utah, was running great. Got to the place that we stayed at about 10 p.m.
Yeah, as you guys know, if you follow us, we bought like a little 2-bedroom apartment because we spend so much time there. So we have a little bureau in Moab. So we got there and I was happy to have a toilet.
Yes.
Which was, you know, it was a godsend.
Critical.
So I was like, okay, no more jumping in and out of the car, dealing with the pillow. And then I spent the whole night, of course, on the toilet.
Yeah.
That was not good.
It was a bad night. But we get up in the morning. We've got some internet guys come do some stuff. And then we're like, well, let's go take it to breakfast and then we'll go hit the road.
No, we were going to go get some Imodium so I didn't have to.
That's right.
Yeah, so we're going to go to Walker Drug, which is like the biggest store in Moab.
Yeah, there's not a lot in Moab, Utah, but there's a little drug store and there's an auto parts store and there's, you know, some restaurants and stuff. So we drive the 5 minutes from our place down the hill into town.
And this is important because now the car is cold.
Yes.
This will become important in a second.
It is cold. So I'm going down the main road. Everything's fine. I pull into the parking lot. Everything's fine. And then as I'm parking the car, I notice two things. First of all, the steering is really heavy.
Yeah.
And then there's a little ding on the dash that says check gauges. Yeah. And when you look at the warning panel, there was a battery charge light on.
Yeah.
And we're like, oh shoot.
Oh, because we bought a Mercedes in Georgia and drove back and had the alternator go out.
Yeah.
So you can't drive without an alternator, at least not very far.
Well, yeah. You're kind of stuck.
So we're like, So I'm like, hey, let's open the hood. And the second we went to open the hood, like all this like smoke comes out from underneath the car. And Tommy had turned it off. And I'm like, wow, what's going on? I'm like, Tommy, turn it on. And the second you turn it on, I look down and the oil line between the oil cooler and the engine has become disconnected. And now the car is pulsing oil out all over the place. I mean,
right.
At high pressure, like a cut artery, right? It's just like, and the whole engine is covered in oil. The whole underside of the car is covered in oil. We went through like, I think it takes 7.5 quarts. We went through 7.5 quarts in like 22 seconds.
Yeah, well, and
then when I said went, it went out of the car.
I mean, in retrospect, we got incredibly lucky that it, A, didn't happen in the middle of the desert at night, which would have been a big problem, and B, that it happened when we were basically parked. Because you could see in the parking lot where that line had let go, because maybe 15 feet from
it's like the Valdez,
the
right?
parking spot. Yeah, there's like a puddle and then a huge stream of oil into the parking spot. Now, the problem is, so the oil cooler line, like you mentioned, connects the oil cooler with
the engine.
The fuel filter assembly, right? And this is a line that's the fitting on it. There's a nut on one end, and then it goes into the oil cooler on the other end. And it's a crimped line, right? You've got like this little nipple that it's crimped to with the nut on the end. So it's a part that's designed to be replaced as a whole part, right? It's not something that you can replace just the rubber tube and call
and
it good.
And it had come out of the engine side.
Yes, it come out on the engine side and the high pressure line. And the low pressure, actually, if you look at it, was also starting to come uncrimped and working its way off that side as well. So, like, clearly it needed oil coolant lines.
And it had soaked the alternator in oil, so we were...
Well, it soaked literally everything. So the reason the alternator light came on and the power steering got heavy is the serpentine belt just became a river.
Well, we didn't... At that point, we didn't know yet. So what we thought was we didn't have any oil in the car. We didn't have a way of getting that part... because you're not going to get that part for a ZR1 in Moab. And we certainly didn't know whether the alternator was working or whether the serpentine was coated in oil so that it was just slipping. We didn't know any of that. And at this point, we're arguing because we're like, what the hell do we do? And Tommy said to himself, I can fix this.
So yeah.
You decided that you could fix this.
Right.
I decided you couldn't.
It was raining a lot. And I thought...
Oh, and of course, the heavens opened up and it started pouring.
Now, I didn't fully understand that at that point that the little brass insert on the rubber hose had come uncrimped from its nipple.
You thought that
I thought that that nut would tighten on that rubber brass fitting and then you could... I thought it just backed off. So I went out in the rain and I stuck it back on there and started the engine. And like it, there was no oil coming out of the engine. But like it,
there was no oil in the engine at that point.
Well, there's very little oil in the engine. I think it was important to realize like this was not clearly it's some nerd putting it back on. And this is going to fall right off again.
Yeah.
So went to the Napa Auto Parts store and they're like, we could probably get you one by Thursday. And it was Tuesday. So that was not going to happen. But the problem was Moab is not far enough from the office to warrant waiting a full day or a couple days for parts.
It's 6 hours.
And luckily, we're very fortunate. We have a team here. We've got Andre, we've got Case, we've got trucks, and we've got trailers. Like, it would have made more sense to just to have them come drag us back home.
Yeah, so my solution was, come get us, guys. We're stuck. We're stranded. Please help. And, of course, Andre and Case were like, yeah, we can help you.
Yeah, which is great. Now, as we called them, they said, all right, we'll go get the trailer. We'll go get hooked up. It's like, I don't know, 10 in the morning at this point.
Stopped raining, luckily.
About 6.5 hour drive from our home base to where we were at. So we're like, well, let's do a video because we have to document this. So we start filming, and then this guy comes up, nice guy named Matt, and says, hey, watch the channel, big fan. And we're like, oh, that's super nice of you. And we got to chatting, and we're like, so what do you do here, Moab, Matt? He's like, well, I'm a mobile mechanic.
We're like, you are? Well, hello.
Yes. So I was like, do you mind looking at the car for us, because clearly, like, well, us two numbskulls aren't going to do much with it. We saw what the problem is. We could see a potential fix would be new lines, but like, we couldn't get the new lines. So what do we do? So he goes by and takes a look at it and was like, well, that's probably going to be a problem because we can't get those lines anytime soon.
Yeah.
So we're like, well, that's a bummer. He's like, but listen, like, I've got a day off. I'm waiting for part for another project. And he basically said, let me see what I can do. Right. So I was talking to him, and he had this idea, which was a great idea. He's like, maybe what we can do is we can just remove the rubber portion of that line, right? And then you're going to be left with two fittings, one on either side. And then maybe we could find a rubber hose of the same diameter, bridge that gap, and then find some kind of semi-permanent clamp that can clamp the hose to the little nipples.
You know, keep in mind, this car has clamps that are holding the hose onto it, but they're these special clamps that once you put them on, they don't come off.
They're like crimp clamps. Like, yeah. I don't know much about these clamps. I haven't seen them. But they're like a more permanent solution. And when he was looking at it, he made up the good point. He's like, well, look at this side. It has crimp clamps on it. When I was looking for the parts of this car, there should not have been any clamps on this at all. It should be one piece. So clearly this hose has fallen off before.
Yeah, somebody had fixed it before and poorly.
And the side that they had fixed was holding. The other side that they didn't fix had fallen off.
Yeah.
So he took the hose and then went into town to try to find those crimp clamps, basically. So
which was scary because 80 pounds of pressure is a lot.
Yeah, and that engine runs a lot of oil pressure, yeah. Right? And it's all coming through that little pipe. So he comes back with a hose, and then he comes back with like just a standard little worm gear.
The worm clamp. Yeah.
Like the ones that you screw on, right? You got a little wrench on, and they tighten. Now, it's funny. I was talking to Case, who's kind of our C4 guy at the office, about this, and he has tried something like that as a quick fix on his Land Rover when it broke. And those little clamps typically fall right off because they're not designed. They're designed to hold coolant pipes, right?
Yeah, low pressure. You'll see them on your car, but they're like coolant, or there's some other.
Yeah, they're not high pressure oil lines, yeah. Right? So Matt doubles up on either side. We really crank it down. He's like, this might get you home. So we say thank you. We pay him for his time, and then the hard part is, we dumped like 6.5-7 quarts of oil in that parking lot.
All over the place. I was just, like I say, it was an oil disaster.
But thank God we were next to a grocery store, a hardware store, and a Napa.
Which had a bathroom, thank God for me.
Which is good for you. But for me, what was good is they had like the oil soak-up stuff. So I was able to go to you went to the Napa and you bought like the big bag of the oil soak-up. And then we spread it around the parking spot that we had ruined, let it soak in.
And then we spread around the second parking spot that we had ruined.
Yeah, because it kept dripping, so spread around that one. And then I went into the hardware store and I bought like a little broom kit.
Yeah, we
cleaned it all up.
As much as we could, given the circumstances. I kind of felt like we were doing an episode of Roadkill, except Roadkill would have had a supercharger on by the time we got cleaning up the oil that we spilled.
And we paid someone to put on two hose clamps.
So that's another thing, yeah.
Four hose clamps.
And then we could have potentially driven it or tried to drive it all the way home, but the problem with driving it home is we have to go up two mountain passes, Vail Pass and basically the Ike Gauntlet.
Mm-hmm.
And we were afraid that if we did that, putting that much pressure would and then the other problem is the value in this car is the engine.
Sure.
Right? And if you lose those at the parking lot, we lost the oil in about 22 seconds. Imagine if you're doing 80 miles an hour or 75 going up by 70 up Vail Pass and you lose that clamp, mm-hmm. you're going to be no place to park, and you're going to blow the engine and you're going to be done. The car is going to be worthless. So we decided to keep Case coming with the trailer, and we would meet him halfway.
Yeah, exactly right. So Case left, and then we ultimately met up outside of Glenwood, and the goal was like we meet up in a place before we hit the Rocky Mountains.
Yeah.
Because going through the Rocky Mountains, like, that's going to need third, fourth gear, high RPMs, high oil pressure. Like, there's a good chance something's going to blow. Plus, I-70 is always under construction, and if that pipe blew going to Vail Pass when there's no shoulder, like, you'd have to forfeit the engine to save the car.
Yeah, plus I'm visiting every bathroom along the way. It's not a pretty sight.
No. So Case comes, we load the car up on the trailer, and then he drags us home, and we got home late last night, and we're able to get the car unloaded, and it's still running, and, like, that hose never let go, but basically now the process, we need to go find some new oil coolant line hoses.
Yeah, but they make a kit for it, apparently.
Yeah, mechanics. Oil lines to the
yeah, they make like a
oil cooler.
Yeah, kit. So we could probably fix that ourselves. That's not that hard. But the transmission is going to be harder to fix. Look, so it turned out to be a bit of a disaster, train wreck. But I had a memorable birthday. Well, I will never forget.
It could have been way worse. Like, it could have blown up in Tuba City, right?
Yeah, it could have been way worse. We could have not had. And then we had some wonderful people come by.
Yeah, ask us Moab. If we needed help. People were really nice because the hood's up and clearly there's oil on the ground.
The so liquor store next to the parts store, he was a big fan of ours. He's like, "Do you need anything?" And I'm like, "Well, you know, tequila if we don't get this thing sorted."
Right.
No, I'm just joking. It was an interesting a moment in time, and I'm really happy I got to spend it with you. And even though everything kind of went wrong, we did get the car back, and I'm not upset at all about the fact that the gear. I was upset. I mean, the funny part was, like, as the trip progressed, you know, we had those 5 points. By the end of it, it was, well, the body's good.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah, exactly right. So the car. I mean, I think that there's probably this is what I'm figuring out. And the Viper is a little bit of an exception, I think, but not a total exception. Is like these really low mile cars have a lot of problems. The most difficult car that we've ever had to drive in road trip was a brand new Honda Civic with 69 miles. That 1984 Honda threw up a fight every single step of the way, and this is proof that, like, if you want a car to die, no matter how good it looks, let it sit and don't drive it.
Yeah, I think two things happen. First, cars age when they sleep, just like us.
Sure.
So things degrade, things deteriorate. And just because it's low mileage and hasn't been driven doesn't mean it's going to be, you know, ready to go like it's out of the showroom floor. In fact, it's going to be the opposite. And then the other thing that happens, and I see this quite a bit, is deferred maintenance, right?
Because yeah, right.
The more expensive the car is, the more expensive the parts are. And so in some ways, it's a lot easier to, you know, to shine it up than to go and replace the transmission. Well, and people, so that's what people do.
I mean, I think a lot of times people think that the car doesn't need maintenance because they'll say, like, well, why would I service this? It only has 18,000 miles. Like, yeah, it has 18,000 miles, but it's been sitting for 27 years, right? Like, things are going to degrade. Parts are going to degrade. Plastics are going to fall apart.
Or 35 years in this case.
Right. Nothing's getting heat cycled like it's supposed to be. So, like, I'm almost at the point now where, like, when I'm looking for these classic or used cars, like, I would rather find one that has 50, 60, 70, 80,000 miles on it than one that has 10 or 15,000 miles on it. Because I know that car's been driven and has had some heat in it and has been used, and then likely because of that has been at least somewhat maintained, right? I mean, I think there's a limit once you get to 200,000 miles and you're going to,
sure,
a lot of things are going to have to be replaced.
You probably used up a lot of the parts.
But yeah, like 20,000 miles, 26,000 miles for a 35-year-old car, right? Like, this car is averaging 800 miles a year, which likely it's been a lot of those years not averaging any miles at all, right? So I think that we're going to get this car to a point where it's going to be very good. And it's not far off. Like, I don't want to complain about it. It's got a good AC. Most of the electronics work. The engine's pretty good. The chassis is excellent, right? Like, we can get it there, but
the leather's good.
Yeah, yeah. There's a lot of great things about this car. But this is what happens when you let a car sit. I would rather have a car with rock chips than a car with degraded everything.
Yeah, I agree. And the paint is good. And a lot of these cars, you know, were driven hard and put away wet. And so to have a car that, you know, the body is in good shape, interior is in good shape, is nice. And it sounds like I'm rationalizing, which I perhaps am. But it's also fun then to take a car that needs some love and give it that love and then, you know, come out of the tunnel at the other end and see the light and see just how much you, you know, could have made this car so much better than when you bought it. That was a horrible sentence, by the way, Tommy.
Some comments about our adventure here on Patreon. And if you want to get the show early, if you want to ask us questions, patreon.com/TFLCar. We also have exclusive episodes like Carish Unbuckled, which is live right now over at the Patreon. Check that out. Don says, Roman really trying to own each generation. I'm sure he thought he was getting a good deal on this one. It looks like it's going to bite him in the butt. I still think it's like a pretty good place to park money. I really don't think that we're going to lose a lot of money on this car because they only built 6,900 of them. And they're kind of having their moment in the sun with the new Zero one out now. So it's a really special car that's kind of undervalued. So I think we're going to lose some money because we always do, but not that much money.
And you know, there's this collector world where you get into these hyper expensive cars. And a lot of the YouTubers are there. Doug is there with his Porsche and his Countach. So is Matt, right? Where it's hard to lose money on it because they're so expensive and they're so unique. And then you get to a point where it becomes kind of the idea is that you buy a classic car, and then because of COVID and because of the fact that it's so sought after, no matter how much money you put into it, I think Matt is, you know, having his engine rebuilt in Italy for like $50,000 or something, that it'll still maintain or increase in value. We're not there, Tommy. You know, we're the exact opposite of the world. If we buy a car and we put money into it, it's probably not going to make money, but I'm okay with that. I'm really good with that because I'm making something that is, you know, broken into something that is usable and passing it on to you or the next generation of collectors. And I never came from this world where, like, you expect to fix a car and make money on it. I expect to lose money on the car. So if I don't lose a lot of money on the car, if we don't lose a lot of money on the car, I'm very happy because the car is, you know, the way it should be. Sometimes my grandfather was like that. Everything, the way it should be.
Well, and Don said on Patreon, too, he said, I think you guys are falling into the YouTube car channel pit where you buy the high-performance cars and test them. I understand they are older now, but the only people buying these are people who can spend $40,000 on a car that really should never be driven and kept in a garage. I like when you buy these older cheap cars, you test them. So, like, I think my response to that is, first of all, we're doing a series on a $1,500 Cadillac, right?
And a $900 Tercel. So I think we're far from that world, Don. Sorry to burst your bubble.
We still have quite a few. I mean, the reality of 2025 is, especially with the rate that an inflation is going, like $27,000 is a lot of money, especially for what's largely a toy.
I don't think it's a lot of money.
Well, it's a lot of – objectively, it's a lot of money.
It's a piece of automotive history. It's GM's moonshot, and it's the cost of a used Honda Civic. I don't think that's a lot of money. What? I think a lot of money is when you're talking like Countaches and...
I mean, it's all relative, right?
It's all relative, but in the world of collecting cars...
Like for me, $27,000 is a lot of money.
Sure, sure.
Like $5,000 is more realistic for someone like me, right? But I also think that for the experience you get... Like you said, the average new car price now is $29,000. Or $49,000.
Who have you just bought a Bugatti Veyron?
Well, he sold it because he said his audience wasn't
interested. And what's his name bought one too? Another YouTuber.
Ed Bullion.
Ed Bullion just bought it. And this is the world that we're living. And I appreciate what you're saying is, for me, it's a lot of money. But we don't live in your world. We live in the YouTube world where the Strand Man and where Doug and where Matt are buying Countaches. Right? This is our world. And we're competing for views in that world. And so I think to do it with a $27,000 ZR1 is doing it on a budget. And I also think in the classic car collector world, in the Mecum world, in any, you know, if you watch those auctions, we are at the very kind of bottom of what most people will spend for a classic car that is more than just like, you know, let's say a fancy Camaro.
But I do think we're seeing a lot of pushback on that now.
Because, I hope you're right. Like, I agree.
So I just saw a Hoovy video. Yeah. He's selling that Bugatti.
Of course. Well, he's been paying $12,000 a month on it.
Yeah.
But, just on interest.
But keep in mind, like, what he was seeing is people want to see the cheap cars again. Right? So, like, the cars he's buying now is a $30, $300 minivan, right? An old BMW he got for free, right? Like, that's the stuff I think that's getting interest.
So now he's coming into our world.
Well, we're coming. He's always been in that world. But
we're not even close to the Veyron world, Tommy.
No, but I'm saying
that is so far from where
we're at. He started in the hoopty world, right? That's where he got his start.
He did, but he didn't. How long did it take him before he bought a Countach, right? I can't.
Ten years.
Yeah, yeah. And 10 years ago, we weren't buying Countaches.
No, but I'm just saying, like, I think to Don's point, there is a lot of interest on the really cheap cars.
No, I agree. But, Hoovy makes himself out to be the everyman. But you look at his car collection, a Mercedes SLR, a BMW i... What was that, the really expensive BMW that he had?
I don't know. I don't follow stuff that closely.
Oh, yeah, you do. You know this BMW. It's the convertible Roadster.
I don't know.
Z8.
Okay.
Yeah.
But
these are very expensive.
I think he's
cars.
Seeing that there's a lot of interest in the cheap stuff, so that's why he's going back to it. And I think that we're never going to leave that, right? So we're not going to abandon the cheap cars.
But we don't have the money to.
We're doing pretty well. We have a C8 Corvette and an i8.
Yes,
so those are expensive cars.
Yes, but not compared to the world of Veyrons. Right?
I know, but that's not our audience. I don't think our audience would want to watch that.
We're arguing. I don't want to argue. I guess I just take offense at you making, you know, Hoovy has, I like Hoovy, he's great, but he has kind of this way of being kind of folksy and making himself seem like he's the everyman. But if you look at his car collection, it is certainly nowhere near what an everyman car collection would be.
Well, so Tad P brings up a good point. Hoovy started in hoopty land and followed the influencer trend when he got into exotics, but he admitted that's not what his audience was really into and has been rewarded with the more modest hoopty, right? So, like, I think that there's a trend back now to more affordable cars, which we're not going away from, right? We still got Terry.
Is there a trend back? Or is it just him doing it?
No,
I'm not sure there's a trend back to
push. I think there's a push against the expensive stuff these days. Every comment now on any new car we review is like, these cars are too expensive, right? So I think there is genuine interest and excitement around that really affordable end of the spectrum.
I'm not sure. I don't see it. I just see Hoopty maybe, you know, flew a little too close to the sun, and so it got his wings burned, and so he came back down. Look at what, like, Tavares is doing, right? He's not doing cheaper stuff. He's doing McLaren P1s, which is, you know, once again, same level as a Bugatti. I just think Ed Bullion, Veyron as well, Doug, Porsche 918, Countach, Matt Farah, Countach. He just spent $100,000 on a Manx, and I think the reason for this is because people on YouTube want to see interesting and unique and, I think, kind of crazy stuff. And, you know, yeah, we're doing a Tercel, but what are the views on the Tercel? It's going to be limited because it's kind of, you know, it's kind of an everyman
car. Watch it. People like Terry. Terry's performing really well, though.
I'm not saying he's not performing well, but in terms of views compared to what these guys are getting with Veyrons, you're not pulling a million views on a Tercel, Tommy.
No, but we pulled 9 million on a Model T.
Yes. So we got lucky with that. Once again, our audience, I think, likes that because that's a $10,000 car.
Yeah.
So I just feel like, we've always been what we've always been, which is kind of the everyman channel, right? And we don't stray away from that. So when Don says we're doing these supercars, I think to myself, in YouTube world, it's not that super.
Well, let's move on.
Yeah, agreed.
What else do you want to talk about?
Well, I want to talk about some of the other pitfalls of buying classic cars because we've bought a lot of them.
Not really.
No? Okay.
I think we should move on to other stuff.
What
I think
do you want to talk about?
We've really hit the classic car thing. I want to talk about the Jeep Cherokee. So there's a new Jeep Cherokee out there.
Okay.
New generation called the KM. Which is creating quite a bit of controversy online. So Jeep has done this thing where they're trying to tie back to their Cherokee lineage and with the X-Gen. They did this big reveal of this new Cherokee in New York where they had a barge and then they brought out all these old Cherokees and they brought out LL Cool J and they're trying to do like this 90s thing. But I almost feel like they've gone a little too far with it because they're trying to lean deep into that heritage. But the car doesn't really reflect that heritage.
How so? What about it doesn't reflect that heritage?
Well, what about that says Jeep Cherokee?
Well, I'm not talking about the design, but does it have the off-road DNA that a Wrangler would have?
No.
That's the fountainhead, right? That's what everything flows from. Does it have?
No.
Is there a Trailhawk version?
No.
Oh, that's a problem.
I just think that, like, and I think they are working on a Trailhawk version. They haven't announced anything. But, like, what made that old Cherokee so special is it was relatively affordable, first of all. You could get into it pretty affordably. And it represented a lot of capability in a very simple package that was very accessible to everybody, that was different than what Honda was doing with the CR-V at the time. It was different than what Toyota was doing with the introduction of the RAV4, right? It was very uniquely American with the solid axle construction and this really kind of flexible suspension setup. The new Cherokee, I'm not sure why you'd buy a new Cherokee over like a RAV4 or CR-V, because it's got a lot of the same components. It's a turbo four-cylinder with the hybrid and a planetary gear set CVT. And it just like it doesn't move the needle in any way, and it's relatively affordable. I think it starts like in the mid to high 30s, gets 500 miles on a single tank, which is cool. But I feel like Jeep has fallen in that trap where they went so far toward like, this is what the consumers are buying, it's working for Toyota, it's going to work for us. And I'm not sure that's the case with the Cherokee nameplate.
So it's no secret, Tommy, that Jeep has, since Jim Morrison left, has gone through a series of different CEOs, and that always signals to me that the company isn't sure where it should be going, right? They're trying to find a path forward. And the path forward is very straightforward. It's very actually easy to spot if you know what to look for. And take a look at what's happening in the rest of the industry, where Honda's coming out with these Trail Sport and Hyundai's coming up with these XRTs, right? These are all vehicles that are on-road vehicles but have kind of an off-road heritage to them. I shouldn't say heritage, have an off-road sheen to them, where they put on knobby tires, where they put on maybe some recovery points and make them much more off-road worthy. I think Jeep needs to, you know, lean in or double down on its off-road heritage, and that all starts with the Wrangler. And the problem was, of course, that Jeep had that world all to itself until the Bronco came along. And the answer when the Bronco did come along was a refreshed grille and a bigger screen. And I think what Jeep needs to do is kind of go back, understand what its DNA is, which is the DNA of the Wrangler, and then have everything flow from that. So instead of leading with this Cherokee, they should have led with the Trailhawk.
For sure.
Right? That's the one that they should have came out with, because that would say to the buying public, this is... And it's funny because everybody else is doing that, and yet Jeep somehow is shying away from that. And I'm guessing that may be because of Carlos, what's his name?
Tavares,
who is looking at it from a very much a European standpoint and not an American standpoint. And so, you know, for him, the things that were important was fuel economy and styling and, you know, all the values that probably sell cars in Europe, and parkability, whereas he wasn't looking at it from an American point of view, which is it's all about what this vehicle says about me as a person. And that, looking at that, that doesn't say, you know, even though it's you know, in an overgrown field, it doesn't say, if you were to take away those weeds on this picture that we're looking at right now and put it into New York City, it would look just as comfortable there as it does in the wild. And what I want is a car that wears Carhartts and not a car that wears, you know, I don't know, what's a brand that's very urban?
I don't know. I'm not.
We're not good with clothing brands.
Urban
Forever
brands.
21. I don't know. American Eagle. I'm just taking that from the news.
Yeah.
But you see what I'm saying? That doesn't scream to me off-roader. That just screams to me, you know, want to be off-roader. And so make off-roading what your heritage is, and Americana. Make it, you know. And Stellantis certainly knows how to do it in the Ram. Do you see anything that says American on this thing?
Well, apart from the seven-slot grill, like it really could be any other brand.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think there is some criticism to be had here, and I think just Jeep needs to go back to figuring out, you know, what Moab means to the brand and how you take that DNA and sprinkle it into the rest of the.
Yep.
Yeah. There you go. There's my Jeep Cherokee.
All right. Got anything else?
Well, there's another bit of news that's kind of interesting. It's a bit that's kind of near and dear to my heart, because I have this split personality where I love off-roaders, but I also love sports cars. This week, Nissan just announced the last
GTR.
Yeah, GTR. The last GTR. Mm-hmm. Just rolled off the production. And I'm kind of sad about that, because I kind of started my career at the same time that the current GTR came out. So it was about 15 years ago, mm-hmm. give or take. And it's kind of sad to see it go away. And I've kind of followed that car throughout all of its different versions, always lusted after it. Right when it first came out, it was a relatively affordable supercar that showed many of the exotics, Ferrari, Lamborghini, that you can spend $70,000 and have the same performance as a $200,000-$300,000 car. So it was very much every man kind of vehicle. And then finally, last year or 2 years ago, we got to go to Japan, and I got to see the car culture there, and I got to understand the GTR in that context. So I'm kind of sad that it's going away. I kind of think it became iconic, and then it got very expensive because the last Nismo versions were, what, $200,000? And then they became collectibles, so all those guys who collect cars and don't drive them started buying them because they knew. I think those people are actually ruining, in a way, a lot of the hobby for us. All these people who are into the one theme I saw at Car Week was one of one. That was everybody just wanted the one of one thing, whether it's, you know, the one of one singer or whether it's the one of one Pagani. And the people who want the one of one, they don't drive them. They just collect them, and then they eventually flip them. And that could be the Ford GT. That could be the new Mustang GTD. I think to some extent that could be the ZR1X. And I'm really sick of these super high-priced cars that only billionaires can afford, while the rest of us, you know, struggle to afford basic transportation. It's become this kind of split thing where there's billionaires and then there's everybody else.
Yeah, I mean, I think,
and maybe that's my perspective because I just came out of Car Week. Where,
yeah, I think Car Week is kind of a little bit of a, I mean, when there's 19 Ferrari F50s in, yeah, you know, one town, I think that's kind
but
of
it just
a,
drives a point home. It just drives.
Yeah, but
a
it's
point
always
home.
Been like that.
I don't think it's always been like that. I think it's gotten,
I
much
mean, don't you think,
crazier
like,
over the years.
In the 1920s, all these Duesenbergs, those were one-off cars.
Yeah, I mean, you could look at it like that, like we're living in this gilded age where, you know, the high before the fall, right? Mm-hmm. This is what happened in the 1920s before the Second World War. We could be living in that kind of a time. But I'm just tired of you have to beg for an allocation from Porsche to get a GT3. You have to know somebody at Ford to get a GTD, right? You have to be extremely wealthy and have bought 15 Parasegways to get an F80. And I know most people aren't in that world, but it bugs me that once upon a time you could still get a 911 not that long ago for $99,000, and now the cheapest 911 is going to be like $130,000. And I know that's still extremely expensive, but it's just kind of a sign of the time. And where are the affordable sports cars? The Mustang.
People don't buy affordable sports
this
cars.
This is true. Yeah.
Like you got the GR86, and that, I mean, it's a great car, but it's just not a huge seller. Miata, right? Kind of the same problem. So I think that, like, it's one of those things where people say they want more affordable sports cars, but fewer and fewer people are buying
them. Here's my hot take. Miata is not the answer. I think everybody who's wanted a Miata, we just had one at the office, right? Mm-hmm. And I kind of feel like everybody who's had or wanted a Miata has had a Miata.
Well,
and so
the generation's old, but wait till the next gen. It'll come back into the interest.
You think?
Yeah.
I just think it's I bought an NC, which is the largest of them, so I could fit into it. And then you bought it from the company. I didn't drive it much. You didn't drive it much. Why was that? For such a the answer is Miata. Why did we barely drive it?
Well, I think for me it's because I'm weird, and I just like that experience. Like I like Model Ts.
Yeah.
And a Miata person's not interested in a Model T, right? So like I think that like I like cars with bigger experiences, so it wasn't for me. But
it's not the answer for you.
No, but I think for most people it is the answer.
I disagree.
If you just want a fun sports car, it kind of does that perfectly.
Yeah, so I had a wonderful drive in it going down the peak-to-peak highway. And then I redid that drive in our CA Corvette. And I got to tell you, I had a much more fun drive in the CA Corvette because there's this cliche, right? It's more fun to drive a slow car fast than a fast car slow. It was actually more fun to drive the fast car slow than it was to drive the slow car fast, because the problem with the Miata, especially at peak-to-peak elevations where you're at almost at 9,000 feet above sea level, is it just doesn't have enough power. You're always upshifting. You're always trying to search. And then when you do try to pass somebody because they're going so slow, you need such a long runway to get past them that it's just not fun. And yes, the car is lively. The car has a lot of handling attributes that make it fun to drive, but I don't fit in the thing. There's no room for luggage.
If you're a big person, Miata's not the answer. But I think if you fit in the Miata.
If you're a Model T, Miata's not the answer. If you're a Model T person, Miata's not the
answer. And if you're a big person, Miata's not the answer.
I just don't think it is anymore. I think it's just been there, done that. You know, what? There was a moment in time when I was young when my friend Fred collected all these British sports cars. And you know these British sports cars, right? The Roadsters. There's just,
yeah, but they were terrible.
The Bug-Eyed Sprite.
And they broke.
Yeah, they broke.
And they rusted, and they were bad.
And they had Lucas Electronics.
So the Miata came in and did that formula correctly.
Yeah, and that was wonderful. Fred, my friend Fred, who was into it, bought it. He loved it. The NA was just a wonderful car. But that was like 35 years ago, and they kept that same formula, and it's just old and stale. And like I said, anybody who's wanted one has had one. And so it's time for something new and different and fresh.
I don't agree. I mean, I think that this Miata we have now is stale, but I think the Miata philosophy of a small, naturally aspirated manual transmission, that's never going to go stale. It's never going to go. But that's like what makes a car guy, is a small sports car you can drive yourself.
Okay, I understand that statement. Let me say an analogy. You could say like bread is never going to go stale because people...
Well, bread does go stale.
But you know what I mean? Like the idea
quite
of bread.
Famously.
The idea of bread is never going to go stale because people always love bread. And then you go to the bakery and there's all this bread and no one's buying it.
People are buying bread.
But I think bread is a pretty big seller. Listen to the analogy, please. It's Miata bread. They're analogous.
Yeah, I agree. People love bread.
Okay, yes. But you go to the bakery, you go to the Mazda store, and no one is buying bread. I don't know why, but they're not buying it. No one is buying Miatas. In other words, the bread has gone both literally and figuratively stale because... Time has moved on. People have moved on, and they're bored of bread.
I think people are buying bread. I think that there's too many.
Get past the
but
real
that's
bread.
Your analogy. There's too many different types of bread, but people fundamentally.
You will never let me win
because
an argument.
That's a dumb analogy. Bread is like the number one food staple people buy at stores. It's like food, milk, eggs, and bread. That's what people buy. What am I missing? Milk. Eggs and bread.
Once again, I'm not sure that's what people buy. Cole over there introduced me.
Do you buy bread?
Cole introduced me to ramen noodle bowl.
Yeah.
At Trader Joe's. It's pretty damn good, dude. Peanut noodle bowl.
I bet it is, but Cole still.
I didn't buy bread. I went and bought the noodle bowl.
But he buys the noodle bowl and the bread. That I think if we were to run a poll right now, drop me a comment below. Just type the word bread if you buy bread. I think a lot of people buy bread. Quite famously, I think bread is very popular.
It's like, okay, how about white bread? Let's make it a...
Even better.
Do people still buy white
yes,
bread?
Yes, people love
people
white bread.
People go and buy artisanal bread. They buy whole wheat bread.
Do you buy
they
white buy, bread? I buy white bread. Yes. Every single person I know buys white
they
bread.
They buy sourdough, but white bread. Wonder? You buy Wonder, Cole?
No.
Yeah, see, all right, Wonder bread. That's Wonder bread.
Now you're making it too small.
All the Midwest bread.
Yeah, the whole Midwest.
I grew up in the Midwest.
Yeah, but you grew up as a little weird European kid. I know what your parents
ate. You know what's funny, Tommy? I think what I'm saying is true, and because you can't stand to be wrong, you'll argue this point. No one is buying Miatas. They're no longer in fashion.
But people are buying bread. Miatas are not popular. Bread is still popular. I agree with you. I think Miatas are out of fashion right now.
Yes.
Because the Miata's old. I think it's old
because
car.
It's not just the car. The concept is old. No, right? When we had this conversation. Back in the 60s, if you showed up, with like some young hot thing in a TR3, you were cool. I mean, that was cool, right? Because you had this like British sports car, and it was something very different from all the muscle cars. I was very young in the 60s, but I'm guessing that if you had beautiful young lady in a sundress and you showed up in this... Triumph TR3, you were just cool. Now that car is just like some old professor in his 80s with that weird hat is driving it around.
I don't know.
It's no longer cool. It's no longer happening.
To CU, half the kids are driving Miatas, the cool kids. Seriously, the CU Car Club is like half Miatas. People love them, Dad. They're just like a staple.
I don't think people love them. I think people buy them because they're cheap.
I actually think the bread...
They're reliable.
Yeah, which is fine, but they're also fun. The bread is a good analogy. You accidentally did a good analogy.
He will not let me win an argument.
The bread is a good analogy. Did you hear what I just said?
Because you're saying that because you won't let me...
Because it's the flip of what you're saying. The Miata is bread. It's just...
That's what everybody says. I completely disagree.
It's a safe...
It's a boring little car underpowered and doesn't fit anybody and is past its prime. It was, past its prime probably 10 years ago, but you got to be... If you're a cool car guy, then Miata's the answer. And I'm like saying, no, it's not. There are other cooler cars that have become that. Damn, dude, those electric bikes that everybody's doing wheelies down Main Street on, those are cooler than Miatas.
So I would argue that throughout history, a small two-door sports car has always been cool. And it's cool today. You know why?
That's why the Camaro's not around.
It's cool today. You know why? Not because I'm not saying they're big sellers. I just think they're fundamentally cool.
I just think they're uncool right
now. Back in the 1960s, they were cool because everyone was in big yachts and the little car was interesting. Now they're cool because everybody's in boring SUVs.
You know what's cool now?
What?
Trucks. Trucks are cool.
Trucks have always been cool.
Trucks are cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Trucks are cool. Trucks.
Stop
are
the presses. Trucks are cool.
Trucks are what people, for every Miata that Mazda sells, Ford sells 100,000 trucks.
I agree. Look, the Miata's not, it's not the perfect car. I'm not saying that. I just think as a staple of the sports car, in my opinion, it is still the answer.
I think it's something old men drive.
Ah, well, you should go see your car club. Are we almost one of out of time? Days. All right, yeah. We got
to
go.
Cole's. Hey, Cole, where are you going? Tell me. Come on, tell Tommy. He's going to Detroit, and what are you looking at? Rams. He's looking at Rams, Tommy. Rams, not Miatas. He's not looking
I bet he'd
at
be
Miatas.
Happier if he was looking at Miatas. All right, guys. We'll see you next time.
Hey, we'll have a new Warlock here in the office.
Yeah.
With the Hemi.
Yeah.
You upset because you didn't win the argument?
No, I'm upset. We'll just see you next time.
I'm going to have some bread, Tommy. See you next time.
You're listening to Leaf Filter Radio, and the guru of gutter protection himself, Chris Counihan, is here to take your most pressing leaf-related questions.
Hey, everybody, Chris here. I understand we have Ron on the line. Ron, where are you calling from?
Uh-oh. Ron, are you calling from a ladder?
Well, I was. I wanted to ask Chris what I need to do to get my gutters ready to have Leaf Filter installed.
Oh, Ron, you don't have to do anything. A Leaf Filter trusted pro will come out and clean out your gutters, realign and seal your gutters, and install Leaf Filter, America's number one gutter protection system.
So I didn't need to get on this ladder?
Ron, Leaf Filter trusted pros are in your neighborhood and ready to help. Just visit leaffilter.com/day to schedule your free gutter inspection and get up to 30% off.
Thank goodness. What was that site?
That's leaffilter.com/day for your free gutter inspection today. See representative for warranty details. Promotion is 20% off plus a 10% senior or military discount. One discount per household.